This is keeping going.
Where's our crew? Aren't we their leaders? Where are they?
Welcome, everyone. I will call the special committee, the Joint Committee on Implementation of Measure 91 to order. We have a full agenda tonight with discussion of the Dash 9 amendments to House Bill 3400. There have been a lot of discussions going on in the past couple of days to reach some consensus decisions on this amendment. There are also some areas of contention, and we'll be hearing about those as well. Just as a kind of a comment, there is language in that amendment about trying to get an early start before the regulatory system goes into effect. It is the intent of the supporters of that to put it into another bill and discuss that piece of it separately, and to have the main bill deal with the overall long-term Measure 91 implementation. And also, I am told that there will be substantial changes to the energy efficiency provision, and Representative Buckley may want to comment on that when we get to it. So to start today, I think we'll start with our lawyer, Mark Mayer, who's just going to go through the highlights of this, 85-page or something amendment. Welcome, Mark. 180. Let the record show it's 180. Yes. Welcome.
Co-chairs Leininger and Burdick, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Real briefly, the amendment is quite a bit longer than the previous amendment, but the underlying substantive language has changed fairly little compared to the last version we looked at on Monday. This particular amendment is longer primarily because we've included some conforming amendments that we've had an opportunity to basically work into the draft, as well as to the fact that the commission has asked for an overhaul of the name change of their enforcement specialists. And so those conforming amendments have kind of increased the girth. But again, those are pretty simple conforming amendments, and most of them deal with changing the name of a particular type of investigator. So that's the reason that the amendment is quite a bit longer. It's mainly those those conforming amendments. There were a lot of small changes to language, and I'm not going to go over those. For a 100-page amendment, probably quite a bit fewer than you would think, but those have all been worked in the draft, and if there are questions about those, I can certainly answer those questions if you have a copy of the draft and you want to discuss it. So I'm just going to discuss large chunks that have been added or changed, or certain things that I know people are very interested in, and I'll just pinpoint those. There's, I think, really only five things to draw people's attention to. Some other people, they might have a different perspective on some of the exact language, but there's only five things that I'm aware of that are large policy decisions. On page 18,
is that okay with you?
Sure. Which is a production license. We again have changed the residency requirement from 1 to 2 years for applicants only, and that's going to carry over to all the license holders. Again, this is just a draft, so these are all things that are open for discussion. This is not a PUBS ready piece yet. On pages.
Mark, what page was that again, Mark?
That was page 18, line 9. But it's the same requirement for all the license holders, so it carries throughout those sections. On pages 19 and 20, there have been some substantial changes to the grow canopy section. I think there has been, I personally rewrote the provision that says that the grow canopies for outdoor and indoor grows need to produce equivalently the same harvest when OLCC is engaged in their rulemaking. I did that. I was unsatisfied with the way I had written it the first time. I think the most important thing to draw your attention to is on page 20, lines 22 and 23. There is a cap now on canopy sizes at 5,000 square feet. On page 28, this was something that did not get into the last draft that was requested before the last draft, and I just couldn't get around to discussing it with the folks who were wanting this language early enough to get it into that draft. It's about employment relations. It's really mainly clarification language, given that the National Labor Relations Board and federal law with respect to these types of operations is problematic in its application at best, since these are still federally illegal activities. So we're just section 20A clarifying that our own labor relations laws do apply. I consider it to be largely clarification, and that those state laws would probably apply even without this language. And then in section 20B, which begins on line 30 of page 28, and that carries through to line 10 of page 29, we've included whistleblower protection for employees of marijuana-related businesses who report in good faith that their employer has violated a provision of Measure A. On page 33, I won't go into this into too much detail, but I do want to draw your attention to it. Section 49, which was the Measure 91 provision that handled minors who attempt to purchase or attempt to enter a premises, we have largely replaced that language with the language from another bill that's been working through the building, House Bill 2313. The language is fairly similar, with the exception that I do want to draw attention to the fact that if you look toward the end of the language on page 35 in particular, and this language is now modeled more closely after the Liquor Control Act language, that we're building into this language additional protections. So you might want to take a close look at this section, as we've done a pretty significant rewrite of it. And then the last thing that is major and not just language tweaks, I think, is I did want to draw attention to the fact that Section 118, I've been instructed to, that's the energy plan section, I've been instructed to rewrite that, but I have not had time to incorporate it into this draft that's before you today. It will be in the final copy of, that's going to be pubbed out on Friday. So, and that's it.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, thanks, Mark. Did you have questions?
Yeah, I do, Madam Chair. I guess I'm curious about what is the underlying logic in trying to equalize the production between indoor and outdoor grows by limiting the canopy size. What underlies that? I'm curious about why we thought that was an imperative.
That came out, I think, of the group. Could you come up and elaborate on that? Thank you.
Co-chairs and Senator Farrelly, Rob Patridge, Chair, Oregon Liquor Control Commission, related to the parity issue that was raised. That was part of the consensus group. I think the issue is the outdoor growers have one very large crop, typically, and that the indoor growers grow all season long and have, you know, three or four harvest cycles in a year. So they were trying not to advantage one group or the other. So it was a consensus agreement that, you know, in setting a canopy size, and the consensus of the group was to have the OLCC by rule set a canopy size to make sure that was equalized in the statute, so that one group's not growing more than the other.
Thank you for the explanation. It's not clear to me why that's necessary, I guess I get the idea that outdoor growers have all of their product at one time in the harvest, and that indoor growers have multiple harvests. But I guess I don't understand if, in the scenario that you outlined, if an indoor grower runs 24/7, 365, and gets four crops, do they not? Are they not allowed to dispose of that crop in the usual and customary manner? Or if they add additional greenhouses, you know, or if the outdoor grower decides to have a, both an indoor and an outdoor grow, you know, who is it that dashes about and equalizes canopy sizes? Or isn't that really a sort of question that markets would answer for themselves? If the outdoor growers hit the market first with a crop, or the indoor growers decide they want to expand their production capacity, when we would, I can't imagine we would limit other crops in the similar manner to the, so that we could equalize the growers, the corn growers, or the. I wasn't in the meeting, so I don't understand the background logic. But we're starting everybody out at the same place. Is that the underlying logic,
Co-Chairs and Senator Fairley? That is the underlying logic. That, you know, if you limited a, you know, an outdoor grower to 5,000 square feet and an indoor grower to 5,000 square feet, an indoor grower could grow a lot more crop because they'll have four different crops in a season as opposed to the outdoor grower. So it was not equitable if you were setting a canopy size related to this. And, you know, this committee's heard about canopy sizes and plant sizes and, you know, plant limits and those things. And I think that there's a lot of question about what's going to happen in the market here. And so that's why there was an interest in setting a canopy size. I don't think the group as a consensus believes that, you know, everything, it should be totally uncontrolled and there should be no canopy size limits. That's what the group decided as a consensus, and trying to make sure the market matures in a manner that will work and not overrun the market also, I think, is a concern that I've heard on multiple occasions. So, you know, they have people that are out there trying to buy 30,000 square foot warehouses, and, you know, there's all kinds of different things that are going on that are going to affect this market. And I think that there's also a strong interest in trying to give Oregonians an opportunity. They've called themselves the marijuana pioneers, to give the pioneers in Oregon an opportunity to really grow the product that's existed here.
So we are again at the end of the Oregon Trail and waiting for the for the first of the pioneers to bring their Conestoga wagons across. I don't get it. I guess that I expected there to be a lot of market forces in effect, and that a free market would, pardon the expression, weed out the underproducers and advantage the overproducers, and that people would migrate from outdoor to indoor as their opportunities became clear and the market responded. That, you know, it's a unit cost issue just like any other business. I guess starting them out on an equal footing is great. What provisions are you making for the place or in time when people start clearly having the ability to demonstrate greater production methods and more efficiencies in one, on either in the outdoor or the indoor grow? Is there any way to rebalance the equities, or are we going to force folks to suppress one market that's successful in favor of another market that might not be?
Representative Bleininger.
Thanks. Thank you, Co-Chair Burdick. I'm going to take a crack at articulating what I heard people saying, and I think, you know, we're in a draft mode, so it's great to get your feedback, but I don't want Chair Patridge to feel like he totally owns this concept, because it was stuff that we heard from a lot of people. So I think what the concept was that it would be preferable to come up with a small start so that no one came in, especially if that we didn't have someone come in and dominate with such a gigantic footprint that if they weren't performing in a way that made sense, if they were reckless, they weren't following the rules, that they would be a gigantic player that was not following the rules. And so the idea was to start people in a tiered way. You know, people could, the first year out, they could have a certain limit of what they could produce. And if they did well and followed the rules, they could graduate up to a larger limit and then a larger. And that would simultaneously ensure that nobody launched in a cataclysmic way that was also gigantic and cataclysmic. And it also would let us kind of walk a little bit more gently into this new landscape. I think also the idea was if there are going to be caps, then since, you know, you get about four times the output from your square footage indoor that you might outdoor if you have one harvest versus four harvests, then let the caps reflect that difference in productivity. And so I don't know if we hit it right, but I think it was an effort to recognize those things. And it might be an imperfect effort that we need to tweak. But those were the rationale, I believe, that were in play.
Madam Chair, that explanation makes perfect sense. Thank you. The question I guess I would ask is, okay, after the initial startup, is there provisions to adjust or ramp up or go to a different production level, or do we come back to the legislature and start relicensing or redesignating? And Madam Chair, I don't want to make this a stumbling block. I'm just, the idea of starting everybody out, I think I understand, to favor small production and a start up. What is a curiosity is that we've got people with 20 years experience now being treated as they're a startup industry.
Yeah.
So the question for me isn't necessarily do we start everybody equally, but do we recognize there's a differential in productive capacity and let the market figure out who succeeds and who doesn't?
Representative Buckley.
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's a fascinating puzzle. In a sense, we don't have a free market. We have a closed market within the state of Oregon. And when we talked about the concern about the amount of marijuana grown in the state of Oregon and the need to kind of look at what the needs of the medical program might be and the recreational program might be, starting at a fairly small level, I think from the data that we heard from Dr. Crawford from Oregon State, if we had a couple hundred growers growing with these size canopies, we would be kind of overwhelming the market that's projected, at least from his data. In starting at this level and understanding that we cannot export at this point, I think that we're trying to find a balance point that lets fairly small growers, small business people, enter into this business, help get it developed. If it ever does come to be a point where we are exporting marijuana, I'm sure there'd be a great desire to raise these limits in order to have a crop we could export, given the fact that we can't export it and given the fact that it's possible that we are already growing more marijuana than both the projected recreational market and the current medical market can handle. It seems a fairly prudent step, I believe, to have some sort of caps that would fit within this closed market.
It might be possible, it might be something to consider to, because of the, you know, this is in statute, in the spirit of allowing for flexibility, it might be wise if there is going to be a maximum square footage in statute to sunset it after a period of years so that the OLCC, and the OLCC under this provision would have the ability to set canopy levels smaller than this if the market forces justified I assume. So maybe a sunset on this provision would be the way to go to avoid the problem you're talking about.
Madam Chair, if I can loop back, I can't say I'm shocked that the potential for overproduction is now an issue, given anecdotal information that we're exporting to something like 14 states. But I don't mean to make this a stumbling block. I was really just interested in the underlying logic. The underlying logic's been explained. You know, I counter with the idea that market forces should be accommodated in some way. You know, the sunset date might deal with that. Good luck with rulemaking. You're going to need it for OLCC. But at the end of all of it, if the growers have proposed this limitation, I'm a big consensus guy, and if you've got people in agreement, and that's the way they want to start, that's fine. We're not going to end there, certainly.
Let's have one more comment.
Yeah, Co-Chairs and Senator Filioli, the growers did not propose the 5,000-square-foot limit. That was not something that the consensus group put together. The consensus group omitted that so to deal with market forces and left in just the equity issue between indoor and outdoor growers. So just so you're clear that...
So who will stand and claim the 5,000-square-foot canopy limit?
Well,
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Leiner.
So, that's a number that I said could go in this draft, but in the spirit of putting a number down and hearing response, and I'll be candid that in the, 5 minutes since I walked from my office, I've heard a few responses that 5,000 may not be the right number, to which I say, that's fine. Let's have this conversation.
Would explain the armed guards, ma'am.
We'll be getting testimony on this. I want to move on past this issue because we got a lot of other subjects to take up. Before I do that, I'm going to actually officially open the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3400, since my intrepid staff informed me I forgot to do that. So now what I wanted to start out with, committee, is a short discussion on the issue of taxation. The issue has come up. If we're going to move to a point of sale, who should actually collect the tax, the Department of Revenue versus the OLCC? You can make arguments for both, and so I wanted to just have a short presentation on the two options by Mazen Malik and Mr. Patridge. And if you want to bring Mr. Marks up here, that'd be great too.
Welcome. Thank you, Co-Chair Verdict. This is like 2-on-1 kind of thing.
We have backup for you if you need it.
Great. So I think...
Would you introduce yourself?
I think I am Mazen Malik with Legislative Revenue Office. Economist is working with these issues, with the issue of marijuana legalization since Measure 91 and even before. And I've been monitoring your committee hearings. And I was hoping that at least when we start talking about this, that you would invite me instead of 4:20, at least at 5:20. But it's 5:35. The issues I think that you asked me to talk about three, although I will bite my tongue about all the market discussions that happened here, I'm just not going to get to it. That's contrary to my economist instincts, but I'll leave it alone. You asked me to talk about three main things, is about the tax collection mechanism that you suggest and how it best works and how it might work more efficiently or the most efficient way of doing it, and about the tax rate, whether it's blended rate or multiples, and finally just to touch on the issue of the revenue impact issue that we would be trying to work for the bill that ends up out of the committee.
Mazen, could you speak up just a little bit, maybe move the mic a little bit?
Is this something that I need to bring closer?
A little bit closer, but mainly just speak up.
Yes, I've never been accused of not speaking up.
That's true. I'm only speaking in volume.
Okay. So again, co-chairs, the tax collection mechanism... In the essence of how this bill is put together, if you go to a point of sale tax, the collection agency probably is most suited for such tasks would be the Department of Revenue. Now, I think the discussion is this a Department of Revenue or OLCC kind of thing? And I don't want to necessarily go into agency discussions. Sometimes the agencies feel, of course, that each agency feels it's the best suited for the task, but not having one agency or the other. If you think about it from the beginning, the OLCC and the Department of Revenue are almost built differently. They're constructed differently. The OLCC is Oregon Liquor Control Commission. It's a control agency. It's a regulation agency. That's what it's built for. That's what it does its best work. And that's how it does it with the taxes that it collects today. It collects spirit, and it is not a tax. It's a markup process. And the markup process controls basically the price and the supply. So it has a complete control with that taxation process. Then it has a beer and wine, and that's a privilege tax. That's not a sales tax. That's not a tax that goes down the line. If you push the taxation all the way to the last point where the consumer is receiving the price, the most suited agencies to do that are the agencies that actually are dispassionate about these issues of tax collection. The Department of Revenue has no legs, if you will, to connect with the industry, the regulations, the part of it. It is truly a collection agency with all the collection mechanism that you could think of a pure collection agency. Now, if that is if you're building a system, they're very well apt. These people know how to collect taxes. They can go into any system and get into it. They could build relationships with other agencies. This is the way it is not only done here and with our Department of Revenue, but that is true everywhere else, by the way. This is the DNA of agencies. I think you would take away from the basic tenet of this issue of legalization and going to legalized market. If you encumber the OLCC with, in addition to doing all of that, is collecting the tax and becoming the building a new bureaucracy, truly to have a point of sale tax. A point of sale taxation is, whether we like it or not, is a bureaucracy on its own, and that is something that we would like, if it is to be developed within the state. This needs to be developed in the state and the agency that we might expect that it collects more taxes in other places. So that is primarily where we think is the most efficient way to place this ability and this capacity within the state system is to place it in the Department of Revenue, our tax collection agency. So in that sense. However, the second issue, if you would like me to talk about the blended rate, I realized at the beginning that you had different rates for different products, and then now there is an idea of having only one rate of taxation. From a taxation standpoint, one rate, blended rate, is probably easier. However, with this issue, you are truly dealing with multiple different products. And multiple different products perhaps should be taxed differently. We have a precedence in our state taxation with how we tax tobacco. We tax tobacco in three different ways. We tax cigarettes one way. We tax OTP or other tobacco products a second way. Cigars are done differently, too, at a cap of 50 cents. And moist snuff is if you're not familiar with moist snuff, mm-hmm. Senator Gelser could give you a very nice trip. Ask her about it. But that's a whole different way of doing the taxation. And why we do this, because these are different animals in a way. And you have a different animal in what you are looking at to tax. The flowers and the buds are today in a market that already exists. We are trying to get into that market as a legal entity, taxing legal stuff that already is kind of working. Your neighborhood supplier is probably not going to be affected by how much you put in what stores next to them. Now, the products, the things that you produce, the extracts and so on, these are a little different. And some of the manufactured stuff is different. I mean, quite honestly, you're not going to, very few people will come and open their pocket and show you a Kit Kat infused and you'll gladly go and buy it. I mean, that is a thing that the state is able to control. Because, you know, the idea is to have state monopoly on the issues. And this is something that you could start from the beginning. So it's a different animal. It's not by you changing the price you're driving people to the black market. Because the black market has very little legs on this issue. You are starting a market, and you're starting a product that you have complete control that you are trying to produce on the other side. So you have a different product. And if you have a different product and you are your intent, your policy is to tax them differently because you're trying to do something different, that's what you should do. So there is a very good argument for having different levels of taxation. The last issue that I'll talk about is the revenue impact statement that we're working for your committee to produce. And we're feeling a little handicapped with the way to estimate the revenue impact statement for a number of reasons. One of them is we don't feel there is enough that you have we've been able to put into the bill of, for example, how we equate supply and demand, because everything is going to depend on the price or the amount of product that is being sold. So everywhere else, I think this is probably not something new, I'm going to tell you. Milton Friedman spoke about this in the 70s. So this has been issues that been tossed around for a very long time. And I cannot claim authorship of any of these ideas. But the amount of how you equate supply and demand and how you give the OLCC the ability to control the supply and demand and therefore the price and the amount will basically judge how much taxes and tax revenue you would get. When we estimated Measure 91 amounts of revenue, our assumption was you will find a way to solve these issues before Measure 91, or OLCC will find a way to solve these issues before Measure 91 takes effect. And now I think we need to find a way to allow OLCC either by rule or by to either come with a report every quarter, every month, every 6 months, or something to give some level of how are we doing when it comes to the supply and demand, and how we did we cap the supply? Is the canopy thing enough? I don't know. I think you need absolute supply control of the government in order to be able to come up with something that we can help you determine how much the tax revenue that you should expect fairly to get out of the system once you establish the system and you start the process going. So these are the very quick things. I'm willing to take any of your questions.
Thank you. Well,
but if they speak twice as much, I can rebuttal, right?
We'll hear from Mr. Patrick, who will speak much more briefly, I'm sure.
I will speak much more briefly. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm joined today by Steve Marks, our executive director. I'm here today because Measure 91 put the taxing responsibility on the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Obviously, we have worked hard with the consensus group to try and move the tax, provide an opportunity to, we believe, close up pieces and parts of the black market by incentivizing the medical system to come over to OLCC. In the contemplation of doing that, we also put into place and have put a lot of thought into the tax-related measure and taxing at the retail level. Before you today, that is distributed is basically some background I'm not going to go through and read it, related to, one, that OLCC has a long history of tax collection experience. In addition, we have auditing experience. We have a traceability system currently, which is very much like alcohol. We're tracing it. We're controlling the market, as we just discussed, in terms of the gross size. We're tracing it through the system. And when it comes out of the system, we know when it comes out of the system, the date and the time, and how much product and what it costs when it came out of the system, and whether it's going to the medical side on, as a tax-exempt basis, or the non-medical side. So we deal with, there's also some issues related to banking, which we have been engaged with, which we think can make a difference in terms of how the tax is collected, how things get paid, how it moves through the state treasurer, to provide some flexibility. In addition, we've worked with the constituency group related to the tax rate, as you're well aware. We're not here to fight with Department of Revenue. We're here to offer our services to the state of Oregon. I agree that every tax has to have efficiency, and you have to be more efficient. Mr. Maz and I would disagree related to who we believe can be more efficient. In the seed-to-sale tracking system that we've put out, there's already a module on board. Colorado does the same thing. Colorado's Department of Revenue does the seed-to-sale tracking, does everything, and collects the revenue there. So it's a very similar system that we can replicate from one of the two states who, arguably, in my opinion, probably does it more efficiently than the other two, and will have a much more similar system to what we have, where they have co-location. We're not going to have co-location. We're actually going to have OLCC licensed medical if we can get this opt-in piece through. So we've got all those things in place. We're poised to do it. But I think in every tax, not only do we look at the efficiency, but we also look at convenience to the taxpayer. And you have heard from our consensus group, and you can ask anybody in the hall, they are interested in having OLCC be the agency. We can walk them through the process. We're going to have the seed-to-sale tracking system. We can provide the education pieces, which is what OLCC does, to maximize collection, to continue the auditing. I'm not saying Department of Revenue can't do some of those things too, but we have people in the field who are going to be trained on the seed-to-sale tracking system every day, and I think that we can ensure that that's done. We're the third largest revenue source for the state of Oregon. We do a lot of auditing. We believe, and we've provided in this, we believe in addition to what we have provided the budget committees related to the needs for OLCC that we would need, because we're changing from the grower tax to a retail tax, we'd need an additional three people. We've done the work to get this done, and we've continued to talk to the community about that. And I think we look at efficiency, but we also look at ease for the taxpayer and how to get that done, how to explain it to them, and how to make sure that the revenue is collected. And because we're the licensing agency, we also have some unique ability for enforcement and other items to make sure that the tax gets paid. We've thought through the bonding issues. We've brought all those things to your attention that we need in order, the tools that we need. We've put a lot of thought into this. It's certainly up to the policy decision of this committee. We're not going to fight. We're not here to fight about it. We're here just to explain that we think we would be the most efficient tax collector, and it would be appropriate for OLCC to do that, and we're ready to do that through the RFP process that we already have in place, frankly.
Okay, question. Senator Farioli.
So the date that you'd be prepared to do this is the latter part of 2016.
I believe that we're going to be ready. I mean, we have to have the tax stuff done before that, and the seed-to-sale tracking system has to be done before that. You know, as to how quickly we can bring product to market is really going to depend a lot on this committee. Frankly, it's going to depend on if we have the opt-in and how many people medically opt-in, because we're going to have product faster. So I think that there's a lot of factors, but you know, we certainly have to have seed-to-sale tracking in place and the system in place before we're going to start issuing licenses, because we got to make sure it works from soup to nuts. We're not just going to turn on one component of it and make sure. So I think we'll have that done sooner, frankly.
I'm convinced.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, we're going to move into our list of witnesses now. We have Michael Hughes, who's traveled more than 100 miles. He'll come up here. And joining him will be Marge Lucas and Ed Bergmans.
Co-Chair Senator Burdick, Co-Chair Representative Langer, members of the committee. My name is, for the record, is Ed Bergmans from Alternative Medical Consulting. And I have a few suggestions that I'd like to pass on. I think that we have some very interesting opportunities, and I think the committee pretty much knows that I've been pretty well after the black market since this all began. My concern at this point would be the taxation bit for the medical people that are going to, in this particular instance, opt in. First, I really don't like the word opt in, and I'll explain why. I think it kind of sounds like where once you opt in, you're stuck with what you have. And I think the intent was that we want to invite the medical people to actually turn in their surplus product that they're not going to sell to a dispensary or give to a patient. So if we can invite these people as opposed to opt in, I think it sounds better. And it's all in how we propose this whole transition from the medical to the recreational, how we put this to these people. These people have been out there for 17 years. I think if we present it properly to them and we say, look, you know, join us. You know, you're invited to participate. It's going to come over a lot better than if we said, you know, you can opt in and then this is what you're stuck with. I think it sends a little bit better picture to the people that are in the medical field right now that they are invited in. And that brings up another subject about the taxation end of it. I think that our industry has a lot of people that are sharp and articulate, and they immediately take care of the things that they have, but I think the industry also has a lot of people that don't. If you take 100% of the people, I think a large percentage of the people won't pay those taxes because they just didn't take care of it, and then they find themselves in a position at the end of the year where they owe a lot of taxes. My concern is what would happen is that these people would actually go back in the black market the next year and feed that black market based on the fact that they owe taxes. We're talking about the medical people that would actually cross over in the medical side and make a profit. So they're going to have to pay some taxes on that product. They realize that. They're now making a profit. Well, I don't want to see these people go back into the black market after that point. I would like to ask if you guys would consider, I know that we've, with regulation we get, or with legalization we get we have to regulate everything. It's just a given. So we heard some testimony here over the past few weeks how people would actually have told us that they would, that we were signing their death warrant if we cut those numbers. And I really feel for these people, and I understand that some of these people really do have to have that much medicine, and they're relying on the kindness of other people to help them out. I would ask that we make a special provision down the line to, if somebody has a life debilitating condition that's going to cost them their life, that we give them a special license to up those numbers, but just for that person. And this makes it a lot more palatable for the medical industry to be able to say, okay, I can understand that 48 plants is a pretty good size grow and I can take it, but these people that have the additional needs will have an avenue that they can actually get a license to grow some more and fulfill their needs that way.
Okay, if you could kind of wrap up, that'd be great.
Okay, great. That's basically what I'd like to ask you. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Who would like to go next?
Go ahead.
Good evening. My name is Margo Lucas. I just wanted to start this evening by addressing the co-chairs of the committee and thanking all the members for all their hard work this session. Again, my name is Margot Lucas, and I own the Alternative Relief Clinic, as well as Cowgirl Cannabis, and am a current applicant for a dispensary license. I am a farmer and an EFU land use owner, so I wanted to direct my comments tonight to Section 34.2A of the Dash 9 amendments. And I also just want to mention I am a greenhouse grower, an outdoor grower, and an indoor grower. So I reside on an area called the American Bottomlands, directly across the river from here in the Buena Vista area. Some beautiful farmland exists out there. And I, like I say, I did want to speak about the land use issues and specifically Section 34.2A, which does not allow marijuana farmers to be included in some of the farm use rights here in Oregon. And I believe that marijuana farmers should not be exempt from the gross incomes test specifically in order to develop a dwelling on their farmland. I believe that farmers and EFU landowners have rights here in Oregon that they should not be excluded from. And excluding them, to me, seems discriminatory. I'm not a lawyer, but to me, that just seems discriminatory against our marijuana farmers specifically. And I wanted to mention that I understand the spirit of the law is to prevent overdevelopment on farmland. As I said, I'm a farmer on some of the best farmland in the area, and I respect that farmland the way that I'm sure many of you do. But I just wanted to suggest another approach, which could be possibly raising that income threshold for marijuana farmers if you were concerned about overdevelopment, as opposed to excluding them from that right here in Oregon. So I will keep it brief. I just wanted to mention quickly that I would also like to see the zones for hemp and marijuana farming and also early sales. And I'll end on that note. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Hughes. I am an attorney. I'm an author. I'm a farmer. I'm a current hemp license holder in the state of Oregon. I've been researching and studying hemp production for over 25 years, and that includes other cannabis production. I'm very familiar with cannabis production at all forms, whether it be indoor, outdoor, greenhouse, etc. And I kind of want to make a couple comments first, just briefly. I would beg this committee to contact representatives at the federal level and ask for some sort of help, because it doesn't matter what this committee does, it doesn't matter what the OLCC does, if we still have 280E taxation issues and we still have industry people who can't get a bank account, it's not going to matter what you do. We're still going to be digging out of a 10-foot hole. So we need your help to contact the federal representatives and federal senators and say, we need action on this. We can't have a cash-only industry that doesn't have bank accounts. And we can't have an industry that has both hands tied behind their back in the tax issues and getting taxed at 80% at the retail level. No other business would survive under those circumstances. Not one business. You can't name one business that would survive under those circumstances. So I beg you guys to talk to your people you know. And I'm talking to Republicans and I'm talking to Democrats, because you guys run the show at the federal level too. So we need both parties to come together on this issue. Otherwise, we're just climbing a mountain and ramming our heads against a wall and really not going forward. And so that's the big issue I'd like to ask you to consider. I also like you to ask U.S. Bank, who my understanding is they'll be taking the tax dollars from the state. And I would ask you to contingent their business and the state's business upon them offering accounts to licensees. Under the DOT and the Department of Justice recommendations and guidelines, banks can do business with a cannabis industry businesses. And in fact, I think in the first quarter of 2014, there were over 700 limited SARs filed. And the limited SARs are basically saying, we're doing business with the cannabis business. We've vetted them. We've made sure they are state licensed. And the only reason we're filing this limited SAR is so that the Department of Treasury and the DOJ can track the amount of money that this industry is creating. The problem is a lot of the banks are really not wanting to do that. And perhaps if we made it contingent upon U.S. Bank getting all these tax dollars upon them offering accounts to the licensees, it might make their decision a little easier on whether they're going to take the money or not. So that's another thing I'd ask you guys to consider. I'd like to kind of remind you guys that there are a lot of voices out there that really aren't heard. They don't have the money to hire lobbyists. They're not a part of any ad hoc committee. They're not any insiders. So I hope you guys remember there are a lot of people out there who are interested in this who really don't have a voice in this process and often feel frustrated about this process and feel that, you know, unless you got a bunch of money, you don't have any say in this process. So I hope you all remember that. With regard to Section 33 in the setup bill, or in the House Bill 3400, which we're here to talk about, and the land use issues, and she covered some of those. It seems weird to me that we're going to acknowledge cannabis production as farm use and farming practice and ag activity under the statute, but then turn around and kind of create special zoning rules for cannabis production. For example, I would argue that this preclusion from current farmers on EFU having a dwelling is going to keep farmers like this person from actually getting a license, because the locals are going to say, wait a minute, this isn't a permitted use under the zone. You're growing cannabis. You're doing a commercial activity. You've got an OLCC license. We're not going to give you a license. So there could be many family farmers that, because of this provision and the way the locals interpret it, could get, or even the OLCC interprets it, could not even get a license to produce cannabis under the OLCC. And that would be a shame if all of a sudden, because of this provision, this person couldn't get a license. This person is growing indoors, outdoors, and greenhouse. She's covering all three major areas of production that occur in the state. And that leads me to my next point, which is, where's greenhouse production in all this? There's three main ways to produce cannabis in this state, and it's indoors, and it's outdoors, and it's greenhouse. And I'll give you the hierarchy of weed, as I call it, or the cannabis consumer preference. And this is where the big market for flower is. That's indoor-produced cannabis. And let me tell you something. Oregon indoor producers are some of the best in the world, without question. There's no doubt about it. But that's what's feeding the flower market. We have to understand that this market, this consumer market, is rapidly changing. Colorado found that out the first year very quickly. They saw like 60% of recreational users were doing edibles. So when we talk about production, and I've heard some production statistics bandied about, I don't necessarily agree with them. I know Oregon producers produce a lot of cannabis, but we have to understand there's basic markets for the flower, and then there's now secondary markets. Outdoor producers in Representative Buckley's area will find that their biggest market is going to be for oil and for extracts, because, frankly, I mean, other than some old schoolers like me who have some appreciation for homegrown, not a lot of the people in the dispensaries are looking to, hey, you got some killer outdoor top shelf for me. And that's just reality. No offense to outdoor growers. I love outdoor growers. That's where I entered this industry as a child back in the 1980s. But the truth of the matter is, we have other markets, and we're going to need more cannabis for those other markets. In other words, we can't just rely on estimates for flower production. We have to realize that if we're doing extracts and edibles, we need to produce 3, 4, 5 times the amount just to cover that market. So, and that's where indoor production is going to, or outdoor production will be huge. Greenhouse production is eventually going to be huge. Greenhouse production on my side of the mountain over in Bend and the high desert is going to be huge, because it's an ideal climate to do greenhouse production year round. Forget about some other federal issues involving water rights that I won't get into, because that's a whole other can of worms.
If we could wrap it up.
Yes, please. I will. The main thing I want you to understand is we need to have some provisions to cover greenhouse production, because as I read it, it's going to be considered outdoor production. I would also suggest this. You are never going to deal with the black market in state, ever, ever, ever going to deal with the black market in state until you are producing cannabis at such a cheap level that they can't compete. And I know Oregon producers can do that. I know they can produce enough cannabis to bring the cost down. Now, I know some producers may not like that. They may have their business plan set for a $3,000 a pound business plan. And I tell my clients, get the eraser out and start bringing that number down. Because the truth of the matter is, we're never going to deal with the black market until we scale this industry. And by scaling this industry, I don't mean we got to have 10 million square foot grows, but I mean you allow a person to scale their operation. A small organic farmer on 4 acres tries to scale their operation so they can utilize the 4 acres. If we have canopy size limits or plant limits, or even, I heard the craziest thing I heard was the quotas. we're going to limit production. And by limiting production, you're going to eventually have a supply side issue, especially considering the market is going away from flour consumption and towards edibles and oil consumption. And if we do that, you're just basically inviting the black market back in. I suggest you allow somebody to get a license for the premise, and if they've got 10 acres, utilize the 10 acres however they want. People shouldn't have to get a separate license because they do greenhouse, indoor, and outdoor. That's a diversified operation. That's the type of operation that normal conventional farming does. You don't see a lot of conventional farmers that just do one crop. They diversify. That's how they make money. So I just ask you guys to consider some of that. I appreciate all your hard work, and I appreciate you guys giving me something to watch at midnight when I'm done with my other work, and you have this on replay so I can watch it. So thank you very much.
Oh, my goodness. So, thank you. Okay, questions. Senator Farrelly.
Not so much a question, but thanks for the testimony on the issue of finance and banking. Yeah. There's an ad hoc group working. Members of the committee have the list of the names and the contact folks, which I hope gets posted on OLIS. Adam, I don't know if you've gotten a copy, but I'll make sure you get it. But we are proposing a joint memorial to Congress that will, in fact, ask for some resolution on the banking issue, and it's connected directly to the rescheduling of Class 1 to 2. But just FYI, the Department of Justice, MBank, Northwest Credit Union Association, Oregon State Treasury, Bankers Association, Department of Justice, the Oregon State Treasury, DCBS, Business Oregon, Department of Revenue, and the Governor's Office are all working together on to whom we direct those contacts. Is it the Federal Reserve Bank? Yes. Is it all of the state agency associations like NCUOA? Is it the Governor's Association, WGA? Is it NAG, the National Association of Attorneys General? Yes. It's all those different folks that we interface with in 33 states that have, in fact, some legalization of medical marijuana.
And Texas joined the fray, too, I think.
Yeah, 34 states. And also four states who have recreational legalization and the District of Columbia all have to solve the same banking problem in order for an industry to take root in anywhere, Oregon or elsewhere. So, you know, the delicious paradox, Madam Chair, is that the Department of Revenue can accept direct payments for tax obligations from a grower and deposit that money into an account. It's at U.S. Bank. It's commingled with federal payments.
Right.
But that is not the definition of money laundering because it's the state. They also take individual tax payments at the county level from folks who are growers and who will be licensed growers, and they also take, I guarantee you that they will cheerfully accept your $100 bill stacks for your personal income tax. They will take your money. So bottom line is apparently the state of Oregon has solved the money problem and the banking problem for revenue. We simply need that to generalize to this industry, and we're working on it.
Excellent. I appreciate it.
Ma'am, relative to your issue on the minimum parcel size and the farming of cannabis recognized as a true crop, it is the worst form of hypocrisy for the land use system in this state to be so corrupted and manipulated that we say you can grow alfalfa and have your home there, but you can't grow marijuana and have your home there with the same minimum parcel size requirements and the same income test. You know, if that's the kind of hypocrisy Oregonians want to embrace so that we can fudge this thing and, you know, keep our values intact, I don't want to be any part of it. So I guess what I'm trying to tell you is for years people have struggled with the income test. Now comes a crop where people can meet the income test, so you're going to move the goalposts.
Yeah,
I call foul. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to be Don Morris, Anthony Johnson, and a familiar name, Adam Leininger. Can you get this on all this?
Make it up, getting material for today.
Hello, Madam Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adam Leininger, and for those of you who know my mother, I'm sure you're probably thinking she's come and forced me to testify here today, but I would like to set the record straight. Last summer, I actually came to her with the proposition that I would help out and offer my assistance to the Measure 91 campaign. Right off the bat, I liked this measure because I thought it gave much-needed vital funding to our public education system, and even as a 10th grader in one of the best school districts in the state, I can say it is truly struggling. And so even though I've already played a role in helping pass legislation around Measure 91, I also wanted to have a voice in its implementation. And so I thought that the best way for me or anyone to do so would be by coming here before you today to testify. And so I'm going to keep it short just because this is my first time. But in that time, I'd like to offer three pieces of advice that I'd like for you to take into consideration. The first one being that we need you to support education to prevent marijuana use among young people. It is important that the state of Oregon invest in prevention education. As marijuana becomes legal for adults like alcohol, it will be very important to send a clear message to students that marijuana is not for us. We must not mistake decriminalization for endorsement that marijuana is okay for children. I suggest you to incorporate language in House Bill 3400 requiring action to ensure Oregon conducts a proactive education campaign to prevent young people from using marijuana. In addition to funding a strategy to prevent young people from trying marijuana, I also suggest that the Oregon Liquor Control Commission establish a youth advisory council to share insights on how marijuana legalization is affecting our communities and schools. I think that this would be a great resource in really honing in how the marijuana implementation is working. I think it'll give troops on the ground who can give much-needed feedback and can help identify problems where they may emerge. Finally, I would like to encourage you to adopt expungement provision to give a second chance to young people who have made a mistake. I support this idea, which I understand was presented by Representative Olson, to allow people under the age of 21 to qualify for expungement of marijuana offenses after they have completed any penalty and paid any applicable fine. This approach will assure that a young person who makes a mistake does not lose the chance to go to college, apply for financial aid, or get a job. Thank you for your work on this issue. I appreciate the chance to speak with you and your time.
That was excellent testimony. Thank you. Who wants to go next?
Senator Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Donald Morse, and I'm here representing the Oregon Cannabis Business Council. I just wanted to thank the committee this evening for listening to all of our concerns this past many months concerning edibles or medibles. Specifically, I'd like to thank Representative Helm, who organized a work group and helped get us to the point where we are now. I realize that back in January, there were many of you here who had your doubts about our ability to roll out edibles on a timeline commensurate with all the other sectors. But I think we've shown you that that is possible, and the language in the Dash 9 reflects that. The amendments put forth by the work group that I've been a part of have addressed as much as can be expected outside of rules, and that is where the rest of this will have to be played out. But I can assure you that industry will do everything to make this right and hopefully make Oregon proud about the way that we're going to do it. Again, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Anthony.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Anthony Johnson, I echo Don's comments in thanking all of you. A few points, and I'll be brief this evening. First, about canopy limits. We recommend using May language about May instituting canopy limits. Give the OLCC time through rulemaking to do fact-finding and come up with a good number. And I think 5,000 may be a little too low at this moment. Maybe we need to bump that up to 10,000 or so, or just allow the Rules Advisory Committee process to do fact-finding and see how the market forces are at work. In regards to the taxing issue, you know, several years back, Measure 91 was House Bill 3371. We discussed this issue with various government agencies. The OLCC was the most responsive, most engaged to follow through with the text of Measure 91, as well as the ease of retailers. We recommend sticking with the OLCC as far as the collection of taxes in regards to what the tax should be to compete with the illicit underground market. We need to keep taxes as low as possible with licensing fees, administrative fees, startup costs. The taxation is another thing that will bump the price up. I think like 17% may be bandied about if it's moved to the retail level. We would recommend more around like 12.5%, which goes in line with what was campaigned upon. I think if you go to most medical marijuana dispensaries today, you can see grams for sale at $10 a gram or so. $1.25 per gram tax, as laid out Measure 91, is 12.5% tax. And I think the 17% is based upon what the like an ounce sells for, but most people when they go to dispensary, they're buying a few grams. They're not buying a full ounce at a time for most people. So I think a little lower tax would be better to make sure we can compete with the underground illicit market, and that can be adjusted over time. And additionally, I echo the concerns of Mr. Hughes and Ms. Lucas about prohibiting the dwelling on farmland. I think we want to bring people into the regulated system, not exclude those people, and definitely want to echo the sentiments of Adam Leininger about expungement. So I know this hearing is about Dash 9, but let's go ahead and prove the Dash 2 and allow people to move on with their lives and end the harmful punishment the people have suffered too much for marijuana offenses. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Anthony, I'm going to just throw some things at you, if that's okay.
Sure.
In terms of the discussion on canopy and caps. Part of the reason that that we've been focusing so much on the energy issue was not to anger Representative Wilson and make him believe that we're going to cut off power to his radio stations or anything of that matter, but the concern is about the remarkable use of energy in order to indoor grows, and the equivalent of running a factory size operation. What that would have on our energy grid, what that would have on our state's efforts that we have put forth in terms of carbon reductions for our state, the use of power, the possibility that the use of energy at such a high rate might boost the rates of all ratepayers in the utility area up to a second tier because consumption had increased to that amount. So one of the arguments for the canopy, to be careful with the canopy as we go forward, is what is it going to do to energy consumption? What's it going to do to our efforts to have environmental progress in our state? So I don't know if you want to respond to that directly. My concern with simply saying to the OLCC, good luck with this, is that that they might not be able to have that framework in that because industry is going to be saying, we want, we want, we want. So I'm a voice saying, I understand the industry wants, wants, wants. The rest of the state has needs in terms of utility use in communities and cities and in rural areas as well. And the state has needs in terms of our work, our efforts on carbon reduction. And if you want to just respond to that, I appreciate it.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chairs, Representative Buckley. A new approach Oregon, the Measure 91 campaign, is not here to represent or work towards any one industry. We're here to represent the text of the measure, the will of the voters, and what's best for the state. And the canopy limits, the energy usage, the water usage, all of those things should definitely be considered. But I think that we want to take our time and not get stuck with certain limits that may disrupt the system, and we end up with certain supply issues that were represented in, happened in Washington and issues like that. We want to keep costs as low as possible, and I think that's something through rulemaking, through fact-finding, that the OLCC can deal with through rulemaking, and future legislative sessions can address these issues over time. I just don't think, I'm not convinced we've done all of the fact-finding that's necessary at this moment.
Can I follow?
Please follow up.
Thank you. Appreciate the answer. What I would be most comfortable with, and one of the reasons I support the idea of setting 5,000 as a limit to start with, is that it gives a framework for the discussion. And one of the efforts we're going to make on the energy side is to include language, as Mark Meyer had said, that would have a task force on this energy consumption issue that would be working parallel to the efforts that will be happening with the Rules Activity Committee, so the Rules Activity Committee could have the information on the energy and the energy uses and the impact of it. We have a session in 2016, and if the efforts of the Rules Activity Committee and the efforts of a possible legislative task force on energy consumption, if they provide that clear way, it would be very easy to lift that cap up in the March 2016 session to acknowledge the fact that we've got the energy and the water consumption. We got it down. We know what we're doing. We're safe. We're going forward in a responsible manner. So that would be my recommendation, that the industry not look at this as a cap that can never be changed, but that would be something for a frame for us to start with to make sure we don't set in place a process that's going to, I'll use my own city as example, imperil the city of Ashland and its energy consumption and boost the rates, possibly, of every ratepayer higher because of a single industry that's begun with indoor growing at that level of consumption.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Buckley, I appreciate the discussion. I think the task force and the fact-finding is a great idea, and I think that this is a consensus we can reach, but maybe not to make sure we don't stifle industry. At the beginning, maybe 10,000 works better than 5,000.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Thank you.
Wait, actually, Dylan, if you could just...
That happens in every committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we'll hear from Bo Whitney and Jeff Sugarman.
That's a proud lobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
Welcome. Madam Chairman, committee members. My name is Bo Whitney. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Greenpoint, Oregon. I'm also an economist. I wanted to first of all compliment you on your efforts on these and other bills associated with this industry. I have previously provided testimony on tax policy, and I prepared some forecast-related data and economic impact of plant limits. Tonight, I wanted to discuss a topic that my wife considers the greatest cure for insomnia, that being economics. There's been a lot of discussion on the forecast and the demand for cannabis in Oregon. I have previously provided public testimony in the run-up for Measure 91, worked with Mazen and others to do so. So I refreshed that economic forecast just recently in light of the testimony from Monday. The forecast that I've put together and I've submitted in written testimony puts the demand for cannabis in Oregon at 115,000 pounds per year in 2015. This is significantly higher than what was previously provided in testimony, but I think that with the methodology that I had put together, which is similar to the methodology of other economists, mainly in Colorado and other locations, I think that there's a lot of credibility to my forecast. Part of this forecast does not include the fact that there's a 10-to-1 ratio required for the production of oils, but I wanted to keep the forecast as simple as possible. Based upon my forecast of roughly 115,000 pounds per year, I do not believe that there's as much of an excess in supply as the perception is out there. And as a business leader, I can provide firsthand knowledge that we've been seeing supply constraints in some products that we've been trying to procure. So, in general, Greenpoint supports, you know, the proposed OLCC opt-out policy. If there is any excess supply, there's an avenue for that. Greenpoint also is in favor of the early adoption of the recreational use and sales in medical dispensaries. And I guess at that, I'll just conclude my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Jeff?
Co-Chair Berta, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee, Jeff Sugarman with the Oregon Cannabis PAC. I did want to start out by offering Adam a seat at the table during our ongoing discussions with the OLCC. I think he did a wonderful job here tonight, and I support the provisions that he laid out for you, particularly the expungement piece, and I think he'd be a valuable voice to our group, too. In response to some of the questions you asked Senator Farioli about the federal issue, we actually have 40 members of our PAC going to Washington, D.C. next week. We're going to be meeting with our congressional delegation, with members of the Senate and House, with the FDIC, and with a number of other groups in conjunction with some work we're doing with Congressman Blumenauer. And we definitely agree with you that that is the issue that needs to be solved. And I think it's also one of the issues that the committee needs to look at in determining where and how they're going to collect the taxes. Because we are in that situation, we do have the we are in the box that we have to pay those tax payments in many cases with cash. So as you're looking at where that taxation duty is going to land, the efficiency, the cost effectiveness, the ease of operation, the ability to handle cash, and potentially the ability of people to be able to pay that tax close to home in a regional office might be very important. We don't necessarily want people traveling across the highways of the state with tens of thousands of dollars to pay their tax bill. So I think those are all issues that the committee ought to look at in determining whether OLCC or the Department of Revenue collects that tax. The other thing I want to mention, with the medical opt-in piece that we're looking at, we think it's very important that there's language in the 3400 that makes it clear that patients don't have to pay the tax on either side, and we'd like some specific provisions in there. I think there's been large consensus in the group that we've worked with the OLCC that patients should clearly be exempted from those taxes. I have heard some talk that patients might be exempted, but they'd have to apply for a refund. I think that's the wrong way to go. We don't want to put a paperwork burden on sick people. We can do that in the dispensaries at the point of sale, I think, very easily, and we think that the patient should just be exempted from tax whether they buy something that was sourced by a medical grower or on the recreational side of the market. Finally, I want to address the canopy issue. The idea behind the canopy issue and the equity piece was that we recognize as growers and other people in the industry that outdoor growers get one shot, but we also recognize that each one of their plants yields a far greater amount of product than on the indoor side. Conversely, the indoor growers get four harvests or so a year, but their annual yield per plant. And so we were looking at trying to look at an indoor marijuana producer versus an outdoor marijuana producer and trying to set some kind of limit that would allow them a similar annual yield. If we did adopt the 5,000 square foot canopy size, that would limit an outdoor grower's recreational crop to less than an eighth of an acre, which is far smaller than many of the medical grows that are out there right now. And if you then have to ratchet back the indoor side of that too, then you again are at a place where you're looking at medical recreational grows indoor that are actually far smaller. So we agree with the notion that there's a lot of data and a lot of research that's out there. You heard from Mr. Whitney today that that he has a wide disparity in his calculations and those that the committee heard from last week, and there's been a kind of a growing email chain in the community out there that is looking that's been discussing that particular issue. And I think the truth is we don't know for sure how much, what our demand is going to be yet, and exactly what those production levels are going to be when you look at the flower and the use of concentrates. So we would agree that that 5,000 canopy square foot canopy level is too low, and we we think there is time and with respect to Representative Buckley's concern about the energy usage, we agree that a task force, and we should look at these issues, and we should find a production level that's going to meet those needs as well as meet the production needs and the demands that folks are going to have throughout the state. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Pisanski.
Madam Chair, I guess I apologize to the committee. I was in another committee that was finishing up their work for tonight and for the session, so that's why I was late. I know that Mr. Mayor came in and went over the draft amendment nines. I had written down stuff on the dash eights, and I'm not sure exactly where to start on some of this stuff, but I know Jeff was part of this work group, and some of the questions I was going to be asking earlier was the purpose of and the reasoning for the 50-50 split as to on the indoor-outdoor, trying to get this. I mean, it seems like we're trying to artificially massage or control the market, and why don't we just let the market bear itself?
Well, Chairs Leininger and Burdick, Senator Przanski, I think we can, you know, if we do allow the market forces to control that, I think that's fine. We were trying, as we kind of discussed this issue, to put some parity between the ability of an indoor grower versus an outdoor grower to grow approximately the same size yield if we were going to set production limits. This was not to say that all outdoor growers compared to all indoor growers should be 50-50. It was more of an equity basis per licensee or per person. In the original version, I think it talked about a marijuana producer and comparing that yield. So I think that's a little bit different way of looking at it than this draft is in there. And I think as we discussed that, we were just trying to find a fair way to set those levels for an indoor grower and an outdoor grower. If the decision of the committee is to go with the market forces, we will abide by that as well.
Yeah, and Senator Przanski, we had an extensive discussion of this at the beginning when you weren't able to be here. You might want to go back and listen to some of that testimony because it was discussed in depth. And I might suggest for your comments, I know you had specific comments on the draft, we're going to end up with Mr. Patridge from OLCC, and it might be, he was kind of the ringleader of this consensus group, and we might want to hold him off till then.
Be glad to do that.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Jeff, just to elaborate, just to clarify on the point that Senator Pransky, the idea isn't that the OSSC will do one outdoor license for every one indoor license. That's not the idea.
Chairs Burdick and Leininger, Representative Buckley, that's correct.
Correct.
That's correct.
And can I ask if I ask a follow on the canopy? I think one reason 5,000 appealed to me was because, and correct me if this is not the same understanding you have, is that 5,000 foot canopy outdoors is about 96 plants, which was the constant reference during the conversation about medical marijuana, about the size of a grow and a concern about grows being of a certain size. That's the information I had. I don't know if you had that same information.
Chairs Leininger and Burdick, Representative Buckley, that is not the same information I have. I know that many of the outdoor growers I've talked to are on significantly larger parcels of land. Whether that's just 96 plants or more than that, I don't 100% know, but I know that 98% of the grow sites that are listed in Oregon today are under 48 plants, and they are also much larger than just an eighth of an acre right now. And I think you if you correlate that back to the indoor grows too, I think you'd find the same thing as well.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Next, our last panel will be Jennifer Alexander and Les Helgeson. And Pete, how about we'll take you after OLCC? Is that good for you? Welcome. If you could keep your comments brief, we would appreciate it. It's been a good discussion.
I will try to be as brief as possible, and I've sent you guys a lot of written testimony. It's good to finally come to talk to you in person. I sent you written testimony last night.
Would you give your name,
please? Oh, Jennifer Alexander, sorry. The few things that I want to talk about, I wanted to come down here to make it clear that I think that we're doing a lot of really good things with this committee, but I think that by and large, it seems like the consumers aren't really being considered at the end of each day. And I think that we need to put a little more focus on what the consumers want, as opposed to just what the industry wants and what the state wants and what the agencies like Department of Revenue and OLCC want. I just want to be really frank with you guys and say that I lost my medical marijuana card 2 years ago when I couldn't afford the increased fees. I have not had a medical card since then, and I have continued to buy marijuana since then, and I will continue to get marijuana for the next year, 2 years, whatever it may be, before you guys put this retail in place. It's important that we realize that this market exists and will continue to exist and will continue to evolve with or without the mechanisms in place to make it reality. I think that the best thing that this committee can do is to take Senator Farioli's suggestion of the July 1st start. I put it in my written testimony. John Sejo recommended the same thing, I think, last week, that we open up medical marijuana dispensaries to sales to adults and maybe do it without taxation initially, because that's going to be the best mechanism for bringing everybody into that legal market.
We have separated that issue out, and we are really trying to focus now on the Dash 9 amendment.
Okay,
we're going to take that up as a standalone bill.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say that while I'm here, because I won't be able to come back. Normally, I'm at work right now. the two things that I saw in this language, I looked real quick when I got here, and in the Dash 8 and every language that was mentioned before this, was the limits are defined in medical marijuana laws as mature marijuana plants. In all of the language for adult use, it's just marijuana plants. That prevents a home grower from maintaining a strain that they may enjoy. So, like, if I find a strain that I like, that's one of my plants, and then I clone it and I'm flowering it, that's two plants. And if my husband has a strain that he likes and he's flowering it, we can't even try a single other strain. I think that it's important that we put that mature marijuana plant for the limits in the adult use paradigm. I'm not sure if it was intentionally left out or if that was an oversight. I also noticed, I believe Senator Prezansky had mentioned this previously, about the marijuana plants being counted as cut and drying, and I think that that's also a problem, and that still exists in all of this language. We need to remove that a drying plant should not count towards that limit, especially when four is the limit. That's a very small limit, and it's workable if we take these things into account and we're allowed to have immature plants and we're not counting the drying plants. But when those things are there, that's sorely limiting, as nobody's going to be able to stay within those constraints. I also really, really liked the progressive license fees that John Sejo recommended the other day, and I just want to throw that out there again. If you guys are talking about that later, just know that I like his idea as opposed to the residency requirements and the canopy. There's better ways to do this, I think. And then the other thing was the possession limits. I think that you guys are also well aware of this, but 8 ounces as a possession limit is kind of unrealistic, and I think that everybody, both pro and con, would be a lot more supportive of the possession limits if they were more realistic, whether you guys go with something like you did with medical, which was the 12 pounds for outdoor and 6 pounds for indoor, or how you set it, just something more rational than an 8 ounce total for your four plants. I think that, considering, like I said, how it affects us, just to throw one final comment out there and then I'll hand it off. I think that when I used to work with the Oregon Cannabis Tax Act in 2010 and 2012, lots of people asked me, well, what if the state sets the tax really high, or what if, you know, we can't afford it, or this, that. They were so concerned about the industry. And my argument always was, then grow your own. And I think that preserving that grow your own philosophy is what keeps the market in check, regardless of taxation, regardless of industry players out of state. And none of that matters if you have the right to grow your own, because your right to remove yourself from that market and handle it yourself is what will keep all of those industry things in check. So I think that that's important, that you make it really easy for us to do that as an option, and that'll keep everything else in balance.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Helgeson.
Hi, co-chairs Leininger and Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Les Helgeson, and I'm here today representing interests of relatively small medical growers. And I know last week we were asked to provide some input. You've had lots of workings with industry folks. And I'm a consultant. I work with a lot of small patient growers who they found that growing quality medical marijuana is not the easiest thing in the world, not what we're led to believe by many writers and so forth. So I'm a little concerned about the direction that House Bill 3400 is going. While I appreciate these public hearings, it wasn't until maybe 3 o'clock or so that the Dash 9 amendments were posted. No offense to Mr. Crawford. I'm sure he's working as fast as he can. But it's difficult without having maybe color-coded language for the new stuff that's in the Dash 9 versus the Dash. It's all lumped in one big pile, and we've got to go
through the whole
thing.
And I might just say that this record will be open for people who see things in the amendment. It is a long amendment, and you're welcome when you come across other things. This is going to be an ongoing discussion. So
great, thank you. So that's a good thing, and hopefully I can provide more detailed comments. But I'll get to the canopy question in a minute.
If you could make your comments brief, because
yes,
we need
I will, ma'am. I really think that we could solve a lot of the policy issues you've been facing here over the last several months if you brought the rollout, if you will, of Measure 91 to be as in line with Senate Bill 964 as possible. That would deal with canopy sizes and everything, put everybody on an equal footing. I'm really happy that OLCC has put forth an opt-in provision for medical growers. And other than 964 opt-out provision, I think everything looks pretty good there, and that should be our guiding tool here in how we approach canopies or anything. 48 plants indoors is 1,500 square feet. I also spoke with Dr. Crawford this morning briefly, and he sent me a bunch of stuff and information I've digested and crunched some numbers, which is my forte, much more so in public speaking. And it's very clear to me that medical growers currently are producing far more than even what Mr. Whitney says the market demand is. I mean, it's huge. And I think we need to recognize that and open the door to the medical growers into the recreational program. And maybe this is a question for the other bill for this coming year. We'll see what the market demand is. You know, we'll ground truth the numbers we get and see, because I really do believe that if everyone in the medical program were to opt in, we probably have more than is needed. The market is flooded now. There's talk of demand not being met. Well, most of the processing, the extract material comes from Southern Oregon, so certainly there's going to be a shortage this time of year. In the fall and winter, it won't be that way. So I can crunch some numbers for you, too, and I'll provide that in written testimony since we are running late here tonight, and I appreciate that. But thank you for your time. And
thank you very much.
Thank you. I also want to particularly thank Representative Buckley for the energy and water reporting requirements. I think it's a really good idea. I used to be a lobbyist for Native Fish Society.
I knew you were familiar.
Thank you.
Senator Prusansky.
Madam Chair, I just want to say your frustration regarding getting the draft on like that, that's shared with a lot of us. I mean, even us here, I mean, we have a very diligent individual working through this, putting a lot together. When you look at the Dash 8s that were 114 pages, now we're up to, 180 pages. And because of trying to systematically put stuff together, it's been rearranged. And I can tell you all the notes I did for the 3 or 4 hours I went through the Dash 8s are kind of like, okay, how do we put that together? Because it's not in the same order. So we all share your pain.
Yes, all thank of you. Us. And, I think we're unanimous on that.
And thank you to Mr. Mayor, too, for his
yes,
work.
Yes, he's been heroic.
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you very much. We're going to now bring back OLCC. They wanted to make some comments about the general consensus group and make some other recommendations on the Dash 9 amendment.
Thank you, Co-Chair Burdick and members of the committee. For the record, again, I'm Rob Patridge, Chair of the OLCC, and I'm joined by Executive Director Steve Marks here today. So we met with the ad hoc group just as the Dash 9s came out. I appreciate the heads up from the members of the committee and Co-Chair Leininger. I appreciate that. So we got the heads up, and Adam Crawford happened to be in our meeting, so it worked pretty well for us that we have appreciated that and been able to communicate with the committee. We are working hard and diligently, and everybody's staying together to move things forward. Our plan is to meet tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock after everybody's had time to digest the 180 pages to come to you with a consensus set of amendments. However, the request of the group is to have the opportunity to give you a clean amendment that is a consensus amendment from the group, so that it's clear to you what the group is presenting as a consensus, because it seems that a lot of other things are getting in the bill at the same time, and it's not clear to the community and the constituent groups what they're supporting or not, because we keep having different things. And I know that a lot of that has to do with the legislative drafting time of Mr. Mayor. But if it's possible, that would be the request of the group, so that we could present you with a consensus amendment of what that group is bringing forward and has agreed to, and then whatever the desires of the committee are otherwise would be very, very helpful, I think, as we move forward in terms of making some, you know, policy decisions and having the group advise you on differing issues where there is contentiousness among the group, and that may help lead the discussion in a manner without having too much to swallow at a time, we hope. So that was a request of the group, but I understand that the co-chairs have legislative drafting time period, and Mr. Mayor has been working diligently, and we've appreciated how quickly he's been able to turn what he's been able to do. So
thank you. I think that's a reasonable request. We did with the previous bill, we had a core amendment, and then we did amendments to the amendment, and that seemed to work out pretty well in that situation. So that, okay. If my co-chair agrees, that might be the way to go.
You know, I don't completely understand what the ask was just now. Is the ask that we not introduce additional language? Because I know, for example, Representative Buckley's office is going to be working on his reframing of the energy stuff, so I wouldn't want us to tell him that he needed to not do that in the meantime, but maybe I've misunderstood.
Yeah, no, this is just a process.
Yeah, I think instead of one big comprehensive amendment, I think that the ad hoc group would like to bring you an amendment that says this is the ad hoc group amendment. Representative Buckley then would bring the energy and water amendment, you know, but things keep moving in there that you know, everybody admits who they are when they do it, but it's hard for the community then to go back and say, this is what we've agreed to as a group, so they can inform the broader public about it.
When you're through with the dialogue, I've got a few things I'd like to go through.
Okay.
Yeah, we want...
That's just the recommendation. Obviously, you guys have a lot of considerations and how quickly you want to move.
We need to mold that over. Yeah. I need to discuss this with people on the committee. I see what you're saying. You want to have some way where people can look at what this consensus group has come up with, and you want to be able to see what you have versus what other people are proposing, and that's, you know, the question is how do we get there? Do you have other general comments?
I don't have anything else generally. The group's working very, very quickly to try and dispatch those things to you. We've proposed language. We've reached out to cities and counties on some stuff today, and we're trying to get as many people on board with various things as we can.
And Senator Pruszynski is
May I just make a follow-on comment?
Sure.
I want to thank you for all of the work that you've done in such a focused amount of time, and everyone in the room and who's watching by at their houses because they're so tired from having worked so hard on this. You know, thank you. It's been a giant task, and you've really dove in, and I appreciate it.
Thank you. We appreciate it. And for the record, we'd like to invite your son to come to the OLCC meeting on the 25th in Tualatin to propose his. He'll be out of school by then, so he could come and propose the youth advisory.
That's really nice.
Deal. He should come to Tualatin and let him in.
I thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea, and it will help us on the alcohol side as well.
Okay, Senator Pruszynski, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I guess I'm just not sure, just hearing, Rob, what you're saying, if it's basically you're asking us to sit back until the ad hoc group bring something back. We have time deadlines that I'm getting this is a little focused on as to what we need to do. And then some of the stuff that's here, like premises, I'm just not sure if the ad hoc group has brought this out or if this is other stuff that's come forward. But I've looked at the Dash 8s, and I've got some significant concerns. I know some of the stuff that OLCC, I think, owns, such as the enforcement actions, where you're saying we're not going to have our enforcement inspectors with guns, but they're going to make arrests. How are they going to take on that type of task without having the ability to actually deal with somebody if they're really trying to take someone in custody?
Coaches and Senator Pazansky, I don't think it's our intent that they're going to go do arrests. Those times they're going to have to back off and not make an arrest if they think it's going to be a violent-related arrest. They can still cite somebody in. They can do a variety of other things if necessary. So we just don't feel like we don't have the training. We don't have the budget to do it, and we felt like it was the responsible thing to do, and that's something that the community asked for, and it's not something the commission intends to do. The commission's taken a stance that they're not intending to do that and don't think that that's the enforcement piece.
I have no problem with what you're proposing, but if you're going to say that they're going to be making arrest or that they're going to engage or who people are engaged in illegal activity in or near the licensed premises, I'm very concerned for public safety. And so if you're going to have them limited to doing investigations and making reports, then some of this language just needs to come out, or we're going to basically set up a scenario where it's not going to be good for public safety or for the people that are employed by your agency. Madam Chair, I brought this up to your attention earlier, and I'm not sure if this is something that's just an oversight while we were drafting, but we had talked about having limitations on how close outlets could be to each other. And I don't believe that the Dash 8 had in there the 1,000-foot rule, just like we have for medical facilities, where we would basically not have the saturation of you could have multiple shops right next to each other. It could all be retail. I clearly think that when we talked about this, we're going to have the potential of having a medical as well as a retail shop side by side, because the only limitations they would have was 1,000 feet from each other, meaning retail to retail, dispensary to dispensary. So that's some of the stuff we can work on. I'm just not sure where some of this came or if it just got...
Actually, I did talk to several people about that, and the intent is to have the 1,000 feet from each other without limiting the ability to co-locate.
Right.
And people seem comfortable with that, and I mentioned it to Mr. Meyer.
So let me just leave with two others, because I think there's a lot more that we could go into on the detail. But I've looked at the definition that's now been added to the Dash 9s about premises or licensed premises. Does not include the licensee's primary residence. And it says, unless the commission reasonably suspects that the licensee is operating the business for which the license has been issued within the primary residence. Was that something that OLCC put forward?
Co-chairs and Senator Pazansky, that is something that we negotiated out with the group. Nobody's had a chance to respond to this specific language because it just came out. That'll be part of the discussion that we plan to have tomorrow.
Let me put on the record that I'm opposed to the definition as it is, because the bottom line is if they're running their office inside their house, they've got their computer there, and they're doing their office side of the work there. I don't want to see that as a reason for OLCC to say, we can come in and check out your house. So we need to make certain it's tightened down as compared to doing product inside the house. If that's what we mean, we need to make certain we do.
Co-chairs and Senator Pazansky, and that's precisely why we want to bring forward a set of consensus amendments that we've agreed to. So you're clear, the community's okay with it, OLCC's okay with it, and we're going to bring forward a set of consensus amendments. And then, then we have some other things that need tweaking in that particular definition, and so we're talking that through too.
So the other one I'd like for you, the consensus group, to work through is the medical marijuana grow site opt-in. I understand how they opt-in. I want to know how they can opt out if they choose to go back to the exclusively to the medical side and not be under the OLCC system.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for your work on this, Senator Pazansky.
We'll share more.
Yes, I'm sure we will.
Director.
Co-Chair and Senator Pazansky, I just want to point out that our discussion about the office being in the house was, when we had the discussion, was we weren't licensed and they were aware, right, that the office would not be in the house and that would not be a part of the licensed area that we designated. But that issue came up and we wanted to make sure that was clear. And obviously, for the exact reason you cited, they didn't want people going in their house. We wanted to be clear that the primary residence was protected in the scheme that we put together. And so that's why we said, you know, if you don't want your house inspected, make sure that the business operation is located outside of the house.
Well, I don't know, Madam Chair, if I can just follow up on that. I don't know if that's realistic for a mom-and-pop outdoor grow operation to be able to have some outbuilding that they're going to have a computer that's going to be designated as their office computer as compared to using their home computer and having their spreadsheets and whatever else on it.
Okay. Well, this will be a subject for your group.
It will. Appreciate it.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ferriola.
Madam Chair, I would feel remiss if I didn't somehow bark at or chew out the OLCC.
I'll help tonight.
So, Madam Chair, I guess I would just simply say that you cannot stop the shot clock. You know, this committee is going to move on, and everybody's got free access to the amendment process. So I understand it's very hard to keep track of the moving target, but that's tough, you know, because it's hard for us, too. The other thing, Madam Chair, is the ad hoc group should have, I think, been staffed from this committee, and it should have been operated through a legislative process rather than the bureaucrats from an administration holding an ad hoc group. It seems to me that transfers part of the legislative process to the administration, and that is utterly unacceptable to me. So as a former legislator, Mr. Director, you know that people jealously guard prerogatives, and it is not the prerogative of bureaucrats and agencies to host working groups on legislation before a committee. Should have been done through this committee. I'll take a look at the proposal. It's just another proposal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions, comments?
You.
Thank you very much. Okay, Pete, did you want to say a few words before we adjourn?
Yes, please.
You have to come up here.
Thank you, Chairman, Madam Chairman. My name is Pete Kramer. I'm from Kaiser, a patient grower. I bring the camera for Mercy TV and try to bring this words to the people. Thank you for having this and talking about it. Like with the taxation, there's three different products we got. We got the flour, we got the edibles, and we got the oils. You got three different things. Each take a quantity of cannabis to produce. So there's three different taxes that you can think about instead of the one flower ounce is $35 or whatever you decide. The canopy, that's a story. Like we had this one lady that had three different operations, which is efficient. I mean, outdoor, greenhouse, and your indoors. Our forefathers would be really happy with her if she could have got away with growing some hemp plants and having that produce. The way you need to keep the black market out of the business is having our prices lower than theirs. And then they wouldn't have any purpose. But then you got the home growers that ask for a little help here and there. You can consider that the black market as well. But they're not. They're just people helping other people out. Thank you. And it was nice to hear your son give an excellent presentation.
And thank you, Pete. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good day.
Okay. Committee, there's going to be a lot of work going on tomorrow. We have another hearing Monday, and there's a possibility we will actually be able to meet during the daytime after committees adjourn, after committees, other policy committees finish their work. So stay tuned for possible additional meetings or changes in schedules, and we will just go from there. Co-Chair Leininger, do you have any sneak previews?
It's going to be great. It's going to be a total consensus of everyone.
On that happy note, we are adjourned.
1 hour notice.
Boom.
Happy note, we are adjourned.
1 hour notice.